Please be seated.
We are with Mr. Walsh.
Yep.
A relatively confined set of questions for you. Ms. Dixon has already traversed some of the matters that I would have otherwise done, so one of the advantages of being at the back of the room is the hard work sometimes is already done for me. But I just want to pick up on an answer that you gave in response to the final set of questions from Forrest and Bird. And that related around Plan Change 7 being described as a water allocation plan. And I want to look in that respect to the set of principles that you have included at paragraph 5 of your supplementary evidence, and you set out those principles based upon the, for want of a better word, mandate from the ORC. And principle B is water allocation should be based on water use, not paper allocation. That's correct?
Personally, I would say water take as well, but yeah, generally, yeah.
Yeah, that's the principle.
That's the principle, yeah.
And we see that rollover, I suppose, in the controlled activity matters of discretion in 10A311. Now, A, which relates to the historic use. It's a matter of rollover.
Correct.
Yes. And the plan change does not deal with allocation between various parties through that discretionary, that matter of discretion. We're essentially just rolling over the historic use of an applicant or a permit holder, I should say.
Correct.
Currently.
Yeah.
And it would be more fair, or would it be fair to describe Plan Change 7 in its current form under your recommendations is essentially a framework and duration plan change. A framework for applying for consents vis-a-vis controlled or non-complying, and a duration that applies to each.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
Now, coming back to the your principles, from looking at those five principles, would it be fair to say that the focus of Plan Change 7 is on the replacement of deemed permits and those permits that expire prior to 2025?
The plan change goes a little bit beyond that because it
yes,
also
it does.
Applies.
Yes.
And as I explained last week as well, I asked myself the question, would this framework make sense in the absence of deemed permits? And my response to that was, yes, it would, because you still have new applications that you've got to deal with. And knowing that there is a new plan coming, it wouldn't make sense to also restrict the term for that. So. I think it goes both to deemed permits, other permits that are expiring, as well as new permits.
Yes, it most definitely has a policy direction on new permits. And I suppose when we, as I did when you were giving your evidence last week, step back to the Skelton report, the genesis for this, the focus on that is on deemed permits, and much of this hearing has been on deemed permits. And that, I suppose, is the unique nature of the consenting framework within Otago, which most of the deemed permits within the country are within the Otago region. But when one comes to other applications that will be filed during the life of Plan Change 7, there's nothing particularly unique about Otago, is there, in a planning framework sense?
I think the deemed permits have shaped the environment. within other water takes are taking place as well. So
I suppose there isn't. Yeah. If I put it this way, the regional council must respond to the new MPS,
mm-hmm,
but
correct.
That's like all existing regional plans will need to respond to those new policy directions, won't they?
That is correct.
Yes. Now, the remaining of my questions, Ms. Dixon, has covered, but I just feel almost duty-bound just to raise with you the matter of the change to the policy, the non-complying policy, the scope of which you have assigned to Trustpower by the insertion of the words avoid granting. Now, I assume that you, in assigning that scope to the Trustpower submission, looked at the Trustpower submission?
I have not had a chance since redrafting it to look at the Trustpower submission specifically, but I have read the Trustpower submission as well as the evidence not so long ago.
Yeah. Well, when you read the Trustpower submission and relied upon the Trustpower submission for the change to the language of avoiding granting, which is the language you've assigned mm-hmm. to the Trustpower, you would have seen, would you not, that the submission of Trustpower was actually avoid granting and that it inserted the words for irrigation purposes.
Correct.
As opposed
yeah,
to
yeah.
avoid granting
yeah.
full stop. Is that correct?
That is correct, I think, from memory.
Yes. And would you accept that not including for the purposes of irrigation permits, it's quite a different... The effect of slicing and dicing mm-hmm. that relief is quite different.
That is correct. I believe, however, that there are other submissions that give us scope to make the change.
Yes. That's not for me at this stage to explore with you. I just wanted to clarify that the Trustpower submission has been sliced and diced somewhat. Thank you, Mark.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Page or Ms. Irving. Ms. Page.
It's me for the moment, Mark. I want to take you to paragraph 16 of your supplementary evidence, where you describe the change in language for the non-complying policy. And my friends have asked you lots of questions about the effect of the change in language, but my question is directed towards your intention. I'm intrigued by the way that your paragraph 16 is drafted, because the second sentence says it has become clear through questions that there are difficulties associated with the application of Clause A, Policy 10A.2.3, and that it acts as a barrier for an applicant seeking to get through either of the gateways of Section 104D. Was it your intention then to remove that barrier so that there is a gateway through Section 104D through the policy framework? Or was it your intention to shut the gate entirely through the change in the wording, which is the flavour I got from questions from particularly Ms. Dixon?
It was my intention to close the gate more.
Yeah. Okay. And the next sentence of paragraph 16 says other parties, well, the next two sentences, other parties are also considered that non-complying activity pathway requires strengthening. The proposed amendments to policy A.2.3 seek to achieve that. So do I take from your last answer that you're not simply trying to accommodate the views of other parties, it's actually your drafting intention to close that gate.
Yep.
All right. Can we come now to your Appendix 1, which contains the modifications that you are suggesting in your evidence. Now, I want to come to page Romans 4 of your Appendix 1, with the Roman numerals being in the bottom left corner of the page. Do you see that? So we're four pages in. First page is the front sheet, second page notes for the reader, third page is the introduction, and then there's the fourth page, which contains the words at the top, insert the following text as two new paragraphs at the end of the section entitled How to Use the Regional Plan Water.
Yes.
Well, now, I'm intrigued with the first paragraph. Applications for water permits to replace DEAN permits or to replace water permits that expire before 2025 will be assessed in accordance with the objective policies and rules set out in Chapter 10A of this Regional Plan Water. Now, I had understood from my friend's submissions this morning that the discretionary and restricted discretionary and non-complying applications also fall to be assessed under the objectives and policies of the operative plan. Was that your understanding too?
Whose question was that? I didn't actually hear that answer, so whose question was that? When you say your friends, you've got quite a few of them, so who are you talking about?
Mr. Moore's submission this morning to the court.
Mr. Moore's submission, can you take me to the relevant paragraph? I just want to see whether Mr. Moore made that submission.
Paragraph 22, ma'am.
Okay, and I want to read that. Perhaps paragraph 21 and 22, I think, would be relevant.
Yes. So I understood the thrust of the Council's submissions to the Court is that Plan Change 7 is a self-contained code in relation to controlled activities, but objectives and policies of the operative plan are relevant to restricted discretionary and non-complying activities.
With that in mind, can I the witnesses to read paragraph 21 and 22, and the court will do so too. And we'll come back to you if you're about to bounce up and say, nah, that's not what you intended. You object to that. Okay, well, let me read it, and we'll see whether or not that, in fact, was a fair interpretation of what you say. I can't see it. I can't see what you're saying from paragraphs 21 and 22. I cannot see that this regional council is saying that for a, is it an RDA or a non-complying activity, that the provisions of the operative water plan remain relevant. Now, if that's your proposition as to what is being said, I'm going to just refer that back to Mr.
Well,
Moore.
If you would, if I've misunderstood, I apologise.
Yeah.
Yes, that has been misunderstood. Mm-hmm. The submission was a submission that, in relation to the policies and the objective that the NPS requires to be brought down into the operative planning framework, when Plan Change 7 is made operative, if Plan Change 7 reaches that point, then the Council will either insert the objective and the two policies directly into Chapter 10A, or it could include a cross-reference to that objective and the two policies in terms of where they have been inserted into the operative plan. the submission was not one of saying that the objectives and policies in totality of the regional plan water will be considered in relation to applications under Chapter 10A.
That was my understanding. Does that clarify matters?
Slightly there remains a drafting issue then to pursue with the witness in the light of that.
All right.
Can you come to policy 10A.2.1 in your Appendix 1? Do you have that?
Yes, I do.
And you see that the first line of policy 10A.2.1 reads, irrespective of any other policies in this plan, comma, avoid granting resource consents. See that? And is the drafting intention of those words that Plan Change 7 is a self-contained code for the granting of controlled activity consents?
Yes, it was.
All right. Can we now then come to policy 10A.2.2? Do you have that?
Yes.
And the first line reads, irrespective of any other policies in this plan concerning consent duration. You see that? And do you see the difference in the words from 10A.2.1? And you agree... We see the same thing in the first line of policy 10A.2.3, irrespective of any other policies in this plan concerning consent duration. See that?
I see that.
So we have different drafting about which policies are, well, the term irrespective effectively means only apply this policy, doesn't it?
Correct.
But in 10.A.2.1, we've got any other policies, and in 2.2 and 2.3, we're only excluding other policies as to duration, aren't we?
Correct.
So do we take it from 10A.2.2 and 10A.2.3 that other objectives and policies of the plan remain relevant? So you say, didn't you agree with my friend Ms. Dixon that when considering the policy gateway under Section 104D, or perhaps your answer was under Section 104.1B, that the consent authority would be considering the objectives and policies of the plan in the round?
That is where the RMA directs you towards.
Okay.
Your question is, the question that immediately arises is which plan? Is this the plan in the round, the whole of the operative plan, or is it the plan as in this new chapter? And that would be a fair question because I think I heard the answer thinking he means this new chapter.
But maybe he doesn't.
Ah, well, I...
And that's where you're going, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay, so you're through the gateway,
yeah.
Got a non-complying activity, you're through the, well, I don't know, through a gateway, just
yep.
suppose. Which plan? Is it, when you come to assess it under Section 104, is it the operative plan together with this new chapter, or is it this new chapter?
Well, it brings you back to the operative plan, but this is part of the operative plan, which means that you have to look at this policy. When it comes to replacement consents, for lack of a better term, the operative plan tells you to ignore the other objectives in the plan. Does that make sense?
I think you mean this chapter.
Sorry?
You're through the gateway. You're looking
yep.
At an application under Section 104 of the Act. And now having regard to the objectives and policies of the plan, is your answer that this is a self-contained chapter, so the objectives and policies are only those in this chapter? Or is it this chapter and the whole of the operative plan?
No, it's the first one.
It's just this
chapter.
It's just this chapter.
It brings you back to the water plan, but the water plan is quite clear, once this has been made operative, that
just
you have to ignore the other policies and objectives.
Well, then, why do we have a difference in drafting in the first lines of policies 10A21, 10A22, and 10A23? Why does 22 and 23 only refer to irrespective of any other policies in this plan concerning consent duration?
In my opinion, you could take out concerning consent duration.
For both?
No, for 10A23.
23.
Yeah.
And why you don't take it out for 10A22 is because?
It is a new application.
Yeah.
And I think I said it before, when it comes to new applications, you read policy 10A22 in conjunction with what's on Roman 4, which says that you look at the other chapters as well, but consider the policy guarding consent duration in chapter 10A.
Instead of the policy ending point 18 or point 19 in the water
6419, yes.
6419.
Yeah.
And then what were you going to say in relation to 10A23? You said you could remove some words, I think.
You could actually relate and, remove under policy 10A23 the words concerning consent duration.
So if that is right, staying with 10A.2.3, and the only relevant policies are the ones within Plan Change 7, how then do the fish passage, wetlands and river policies become relevant to a non-complying activity?
That is something that we have to draft in there and make special provision for it.
But I thought the council's position was that they're not going to be brought into Plan Change 7, they're only going to be brought into the operative plan.
only...
I know, Mr. But that's not the council's position. Mr. Moore, you can put your position a third time if you like.
So the position is that the objective relating to fish passage and the policies relating to wetlands and rivers will be brought down into Plan Change 7 when that plan change is, if and when that plan change is made operative, and any consequential adjustments that might be necessary to be made to facilitate that will be made at that time without using a Schedule 1 process.
All right, thank you. With that in mind.
The objective of Plan Change 7 at 10A.1.1 is the same for replacement of deemed permits and for new permits, isn't it? It's to manage them until a new land and water regional plan is operative.
Correct.
If we come to policy 10A.2.2, the status of new permits is determined by the operative regional plan water, the application status, I mean.
It's for new permits for, yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Previously not consented or, yeah.
Yes. And for non-Schedule 2A catchments, the status would be restricted discretionary if the new application's within the primary allocation cap, or fully discretionary if it's above it, right?
Correct.
And for Schedule 2A catchments, for primary allocation within the cap, it's restricted discretionary, but over the cap it would be prohibited. Is that right?
Correct.
The Clutha main stem is a non-Schedule 2A catchment, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So, for somebody wishing to apply for a new permit from the Clutha under Clause 10A.2.2, would that be restricted discretionary or fully discretionary?
I have to look at the plan because the Clutha is kind of an outlier in the plan because the framework does not apply to the Clutha.
Do you want to have a look at the plan? I'm quite interested in this line of questioning and how it applies to... I think you've got five or six water bodies sitting outside your minimum flow regimes, correct?
Outside the allocation regime.
Yeah, one of which is Clutha, but I think there's some lakes and other rivers as well.
They're all part of the Clutha system, but you're correct, yes.
Could you look at the plan, because I am interested to see how this all works, if you like.
Yep.
And Ms. Harlow will assist you obtain your copy.
Thank you.
So your starting provision is policy?
Well, this is something that you may want to check, with one of the consents officers as well. But I look at basically policy 641, and that is on page 613. And basically, when you, the policy says to enable the taking of surface water by defined allocation quantities and provision for water body levels and flows, except when the taking is under under Roman I, the taking is from Lakes Dunstan, Hawea, Roxburgh, Wanaka, or Wakatipu, or the main stem of the Clutha River, Mata'au, or Kawarau rivers. And then when you go to the explanation, the third paragraph says basically this chapter does not apply. Chapter 6, the allocation quantities and minimum flow set in Chapter 6 do not apply to surface water takes from Lake Dunstan, Hawea, Roxburgh, Wanaka, Wakatipu, or the main stem of the Clutha River and Kawarau, Clutha River, Mata'au, and Kawarau rivers. Because of that, it's my understanding that we don't have a primary allocation, so to speak, primary allocation block or limit from the Clutha. And therefore, any application to take water would be a discretionary activity.
Which rule?
Under rule
12.1.5. Mr. Pelsmaker, can you have a look at rule 12.1.4.6?
Give us that number again, 12.1.4.6.
Yes.
Correct. Yes. Just pause for the court to catch up.
Of the plan or common bundle, page 181. You see that? Does that rule apply to new takes for primary allocation from non-schedule 2A catchments?
Correct.
Yeah. And is the activity status restricted discretionary?
Correct.
And coming back to policy 10A.2.2, the policy is to grant such new permits for not more than 6 years. So this is Plan Change 7, policy 10A.2.2.
Correct.
Yeah. But for applications for new permits for longer than 6 years, the activity status remains the same, which is that required by the Regional Plan Water.
For new takes?
Yes.
Yes, correct.
Okay. And you're satisfied that that implements Plan Change 7, Objective 10A.1.1.
Yes.
Okay. So I want you to suppose a scenario where we have existing permits to take water from the Clutha, which are sought to be replaced for more than 6 years. That's a non-complying activity, and the council's intention is that that gateway be firmly closed. Correct?
For when consent is applied for more than 6 years.
Yeah.
Correct, yes.
But if the next door neighbour makes precisely the same application for a new take for more than 6 years, it's restricted discretionary.
Correct. But, sorry, my understanding is that because the Clutha is outside of Chapter 6,
yes,
you do not take primary allocation from the Clutha. It would be a fully discretionary activity.
All right.
But, yeah.
But let's suppose that you're right about that for the purposes of this line of questioning. We still have a position where one person taking water from the permit from the Clutha under an existing permit that falls to be replaced under Plan Change 7, that is non-complying if it's for more than 6 years.
That is correct.
But where it's not replacing an existing permit, it's an entirely new take, that's discretionary?
That is correct.
And both outcomes, you say, implement Objective 10A.1.1 of Plan Change 7.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to move now to your paragraph 24 of your supplementary evidence, where you deal with priorities. Now, in your second sentence, you say there are difficulties including express reference to existing priorities and new permits as they are not currently a condition of consent and are not enforceable by the council. Is that your understanding or is that advice that you've received?
That is advice that I received.
Okay. Would your opinion change about the utility of priorities if, in fact, priorities were legally deemed to be a condition of deemed permits by Section 413(2) of the Resource Management Act?
Sorry, give the section number again.
Section 413, subsection 2, Mum. It's set out in my friend Ms. Williams's opening submissions.
I would reconsider it, yes.
You would, okay. Because whether or not conditions of resource consent are enforced by the council, they might still have utility in that permit holders might enforce them directly against each other, mightn't they?
Yes.
And so even if the council doesn't find them useful to protect permit holders' rights, permit holders as between them might see utility in being able to enforce the priorities. You agree?
My understanding is it's a civil matter, yeah.
What do you mean by that?
It can be subject to agreements between water users.
But do you understand that any person may seek an enforcement order to enforce a condition?
Sorry, I'm not familiar with that.
You're not aware of that? Okay.
Yeah.
The last sentence of your paragraph 24, is that you say that to the extent that existing priorities have been exercised in the last 5 years, this will be reflected in the actual use calculated in Schedule 10A.4. So in practice, the status quo will continue. Can you explain to me how that works?
When consent holders or deemed permit holders operate in a system where priority is still being exercised, water users with a lower priority have to yield to water users with a higher priority. That means that the volumes that they can take will be restricted by how much they have to let go past their take in order to provide surety to higher priority users. That will be reflected in the volumes calculated to some degree, will be reflected in the volumes calculated on the schedule.
Okay. So in the long run, you think it should work out all right because you're restricted by what you've taken in the past?
Yes.
Is that the thinking? But that doesn't tell you, does it, what, as between permit holders, they're entitled to take between them on any particular day, does it?
Could you repeat that?
Well, let's suppose your proposition's right, is that a downstream lower priority permit holder, a lower priority permit holder's take history is influenced by their priority. So they will have a limited seasonal volume that they can take based on their history.
Yes.
But it doesn't tell you, relative to permit holders, how much they might take on any given day, does it?
No, it does not.
No. And that's the value of the priority scheme, isn't it? It enables permit holders to know by how much water's in the river and how much water higher priorities takes what is available to them on any given day.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So in that respect, the status quo isn't continued, is it, if you take away the priorities out of the permit regime?
Not entirely.
Okay.
But yeah.
Okay. Nothing further, Mark.
Ms. Irving.
I have no questions, Your Honour. Ms. Dixon covered the ground I was going to.
Thank you.
I wonder whether you have available to you the evidence of Ms. King. Do you have that?
I do. I had it somewhere.
Actually, I should have thrown her over for re-examination before muddying with our own questions.
So before we get to our questions, any re-examination?
Now, just one question, if I might. You were asked a series of questions by various of my friends in relation to the non-complying activity pathway, and you're invited to provide some examples of when that might occur. I'm interested to understand what might happen to an application lodged for a resource consent for a six-year period of time where there is no data record available and that data record is available for reasons other than those which would gain entry into the restricted discretionary pathway.
You would default to the non-complying activity rule.
Thank you. No further questions.
Sorry, Commissioner.
So I asked you about Ms. King's evidence. Is that there somewhere, or does someone need to help you with that?
Yes, I have it.
So perhaps you could turn up page 13, paragraph 64 at the top of that page.
Yes.
So I have a series of questions in relation to your restricted discretionary activity status and your entry condition C. So you might want to have that in front of you as well. That's on page 6 of the provisions in 1, attachment 1.
Yes.
So you have that in front of you. And you might recall in the context of the schedule during this hearing, there's been quite a lot of reference to entry conditions needing to be objectively ascertainable. Do you recall that
yes.
phrase being used so that it's very clear on its face whether you're in or out?
Yep.
And it's not down to the council or the applicant to basically make the call on that.
Yes.
So I'm just looking at your proposition for an entry condition in C. And I'm also looking at what Ms. King said about that in 64. And I might read it out because I'm conscious that not everyone in the room always has these things. It's not very long mm-hmm. what she says. This matter allows council the discretion to consider whether the information provided demonstrates technical issues. In my opinion, I can foresee some interpretation challenges associated with the following words: demonstrate, technical issue, and resolve as between applicants and council. Now, you haven't amended at all what you had in your supplementary evidence. It's the same, isn't it?
Yes. Sorry, could you refer me to the... Is it to the appendix? Which provision in the appendix?
It's C in the restricted discretionary activity. So it's in black, not in red, in
yes.
terms of the annotated version of what you put up in your supplementary. So you haven't amended it
I have not
at,
amended
at all.
That, no.
So did you have a look at the points yeah. that Ms. King made?
Yes.
And consider them?
I did. But I guess the onus is now more on the applicant to demonstrate that and for council to make an assessment that that's appropriate as opposed to council setting out how the applicant needs to provide that information or to what standard.
So you think that's the word demonstrated, that you're speaking to the word demonstrated? Am
yes.
I right about that?
Yep.
So the question about the technical issue, wouldn't the council want to be clear on what a technical issue was?
It's probably a question that can be better answered by Mr. Wilson, but it is hard for council to foresee the nature of the technical issues. So there's always going to be some degree of discretion that you need to apply, because it might be difficult to list specifically all the technical issues that could give rise to the circumstance where you have a gap in the water take data.
So I guess my question comes back to here. You're saying and repeating that council has to have the discretion on these matters. And I guess just to take the final step, we have also a test of all reasonably practical steps have been taken to resolve the technical issues. Now, what do you understand by all reasonably practicable steps? Is this an objectively ascertainable...
Again, it might be best to...
matter?
Yeah, I acknowledge that it's... it probably could be... Perhaps it would be better if it was stated more clearly, but I'm not an expert in assessing what the adequacy of water quality data. Quantity data. It's definitely something that I would be happy to take up with Mr. Wilson, but I need some expert input on that in order to see if it would be feasible to provide more clarity and how it can be achieved.
Well, Ms. King might have some thoughts about that too, in the light of my question. So if that was something that the council felt that it needed some discretion over, shouldn't it appear in the matters of discretion?
Well, because it is included in the application, council my understanding is council can consider it because it is part of the application.
There's another way of framing that. Rather than having the words appearing in the entry point,
yes,
subparagraph C, that words or certain words are actually put into the matters of discretion.
Yes. That is something that we could consider, yeah. But as I explained, I don't have the technical skill to kind of define those words or identify those words.
Oh.
I need to, yeah.
Well, if not, yeah. I mean, I can see you need to work in with your technical people, which is why this opportunity has been given to council to come back to us. And it's been very helpful. But I'm just, the point being made by the commissioner is that the entry point itself involves quite a degree of discretion.
I agree with that, yes.
And is that valid for a rule such as this, or should those matters of discretion, whether framed this way or framed differently, be taken out and put into the matters that the council will restrict its discretion in relation to? So I think that's the proposition.
Yeah.
Well, it
or
is, but
yeah.
It may
no,
also, but it may also need an entry condition, but a rather different looking one.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. if the entry condition isn't that simply a complete set of water metering data is not available.
Which available is a much easier thing to test, is either available or it's not.
Yeah.
Yes. So I was just unclear about your answer sort of earlier in the day in terms of the priorities question, and you said that there was a difference in terms of priorities that were in conditions and priorities that were in notes. And I didn't understand what you meant by that. I mean, I have looked at the examples that we were provided with, and you did refer to those, but you said that you've been given advice, and you might be working off that, but it would be helpful to understand actually what you meant and even to have an example.
So the advice... Initially, I got advised that it was not a condition and not enforceable by council. When I looked at the permits, I saw that there was some inconsistency in some the permits that were issued in replacement of a mining privilege. The priorities were included as a condition, which means, my understanding, that the consent holder needs to exercise that permit in accordance with that condition. In other deemed permits, it is not included as a condition, but rather as a note, which my understanding has no legal standing or is not something that a water user needs to comply with.
Well, there's quite a lot of case law that says that sometimes notes are the same as conditions, but I guess that's perhaps a point for the lawyers. So you're just operating on advice.
Yeah. My understanding is also that council does not enforce it anyhow.
No, but you've been cross-examined on enforcement action that the users might be able to take as between themselves, and you said that was outside your field of expertise.
That is correct, yeah.
Yes. So I just had one last question, and that was relating to... Two matters. We can just take the controlled activity rule, perhaps, as an entry point for my question. So, if we look at the entry condition V, so there we have the requirement to have any existing residual flow, minimum flow or take cessation condition, whichever is applicable, are rolled over and included in the application for resource consent. So I'm just wondering what your understanding by a take cessation condition might be.
My understanding is it could apply to quite a few situations where the taking is restricted by a condition, and one of the conditions might be that the taking is restricted when other takes from that water body or operating. That could be a take cessation condition. Earlier, the argument was made that perhaps priorities as well could act as a take cessation condition when they are stated on a deemed permit. I can't accept that that would be the case.
You kind of? Or
I accept that this would be the case.
Okay.
Yep.
And the difference between a residual flow and a minimum flow, it's the residual flow first?
Minimum flows apply usually, it's basically one limit that applies to all the consent it takes on a water body. Residual flows are specific to one take. They can be set as conditions on consents at the same time, so you could have a minimum flow condition which requires you to stop taking when the flow at a certain point in the catchment reaches a certain level. A residual flow is often formulated in a sense that you need to let a certain volume of water going past your take or a certain point near your take.
So I want to turn now to the matters over which controls reserved and the new C. So if you turn over the page, I think you'll find that.
Yeah.
And I think you were asked some questions about that. So we have there any other conditions, and then we have the qualifier where those matters are not otherwise addressed by the entry conditions of this rule or matters of control. So we look first at the first part of that qualifier, not otherwise addressed by the entry conditions of this rule. How would you see that applying in the future in relation to those entry conditions that you've just gone through?
So if the entry condition is met, then that if the condition on an existing consent relates to any of the entry conditions in Roman 1 till 7, but in reality that will be primarily Roman 5, or if it is not addressed by any of the matters of control stated before the new matter of control C, then it would be caught by this catch-all matter of control. It is just there to ensure that any other conditions are carried over.
So you go back to the conditions that were in the original permit?
Correct, yes.
And you just make sure nothing's been missed out?
That is correct.
Is that
it is a catch-all, yes.
So what kinds of things can you think of that might fall into that category, having had a look at a few of these permits? And of course, we have been provided with some permits and evidence as well that might expire soon.
It might be that it's a condition relating to a certain intake structure or a as I said before, it could be something that relates to fish passage. If it's already on an existing consent,
right,
we could carry it over. Any environmental conditions.
So something that might, for example, relate to galaxids?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. I didn't quite understand why you say, because I didn't have a chance to read it either, why you said that takes from water bodies that don't have a primary allocation are a discretionary activity. And I think you gave us the rule 12.1.4.5. Maybe I took that down wrong, but I haven't had a chance to read it. So, you know, if you could go through that rule and point out to me, if that is the correct rule, why it is discretionary.
Well, that's my understanding from reading the plan.
Yeah.
Is that the CLUTHA, Chapter 6 basically sets up the entire allocation framework, and it allocates primary allocation, supplementary allocation blocks to certain water bodies. The CLUTHA has not been given a primary allocation.
Yeah, no, accepted. So jumping into the rules.
Yes.
Now I want to take water from the CLUTHA or to take and use from the CLUTHA. What rule applies?
I believe, again, it might be worthwhile checking with the consents officers, but in my understanding is 12.1.5.1.
Oh, 5.1. All right. I am looking in the wrong place, if that's right. Okay, so I have taken it down wrong. But you're not, I think you're saying double check with your consent, but you think it's discretionary under that provision because it's not otherwise provided for in the rules which are referred to it. Okay.
It was discussed previously when preparing evidence as well because there were requests to...
I'm sorry, ma'am. There might be a misapprehension. The rule I put to the witness was 12.1.4.6.
Oh, I know you put a different rule.
Oh, I
but
see.
I wanted
sorry,
to know
I
the rule that he was referring to.
Yeah.
Because then you had that discussion whether it was RDA or discretionary and what did it matter because, and I understand the point of that examination. So your understanding is 12.1.5.1, applications to take and use water out of the water bodies which do not have a primary allocation are discretionary.
That's correct, and that's also the case, for example, non-consumptive takes. Mm. My understanding would these fall also within this category because they're not really part of an allocation because they're non-consumptive.
And then there was a line of questioning wherein if an applicant for a new water take from one of those bodies which otherwise didn't have a primary allocation could come along to the council and seek to take and use water for a period greater than 6 years, and that would remain a discretionary activity under the rule that you've just given us, 12.1.5.1, or potentially an RDA rule under the rule given by Mr. Page, and you said yes, if it was for greater than 6 years.
Correct. If it is not previously authorised.
It's brand new.
Then it would. Then the rules of the current water plan would still apply, but the consent duration stated in policy 10A22 would apply.
And so then the strength of direction is only grant, is to be found in the words only grant resource consents.
Yes.
And I have read your evidence and read, I think, the evidence of the other council witnesses, which are to follow, that the strength of direction only grant
in policy 10A2.3 has not been very directive at all. And applicants have sailed in wanting longer grants and indeed have been granted longer grants than simply a six-year duration. Correct?
Correct, yes.
With that in mind, is the strength of direction in policy 10A2.2 sufficiently directive or sufficiently weighty such that the policy will be implemented in the way that you intend,
yeah,
which is what I understand as new permits 6 years?
It might. You're raising a very good point. Because the two policies, 10A2.2 and 10A2.3, are almost now, as proposed, mirror images of each other, so it would be worthwhile strengthening the policy in 10A22 as well and align it with 10A23.
If you do not do that, I'm just wondering whether and this actually might be a question for the consents team rather than yourself, but wouldn't an existing consent holder on one of those who's taking and using water from one of those water bodies which are standing outside the primary allocation now simply apply for a new application for resource consent, surrendering their old one, which new application for resource consent could extend the area of irrigation, increase the take and so on and so forth, and could potentially do so for years longer than 6 years because
that
of the lack of weight.
That is a risk in catchments where no allocation limit applies, and it would also be a risk in catchments where you have an allocation limit but where the current allocation has not been is below the limit still. The reality is that in the catchments where we notice a considerable demand for water, there is no more primary allocation available in most catchments.
And then there's several catchments where there was no primary allocation anyway for certain water bodies because they stood outside of it, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. And so your evidence is what is your evidence for new applications, that is, not applications seeking to replace an existing application or deemed permit? What was the outcome for new applications? Not previously consented.
The outcome was just to put a limit on the consent duration. Also because newer applications would typically, you don't have the issue of, or the risk of paper allocation as well.
Okay. All right, complete lack of imagination as to how a priority condition could be compared to a secession condition and how that might be able to be worked. So you've again agreed that a priority could be likened to a secession condition. And so
yes.
I want to understand more about secession conditions. Are you familiar in the circumstances where they're applied?
Priorities.
Secession conditions.
I gave an example previously to Commissioner Edmonds, and I am familiar with some applications where this is the case, yes, where you can only operate or where you can only exercise a consent if another take ceases or vice versa. And, there are quite a few of those.
There's quite a few of those. So two or more people can't be taking water The condition might be framed as you cannot take water when there are other people exercising their consent.
Or another example could be where you have a maximum rate of take, and if another consent in the vicinity is turned on, so to speak, or is being exercised, the combined rate of those two takes is restricted as well to a certain volume. It's quite common.
What would be, in the second example, what's the point of that, as you understand it?
It's hard to kind of look into the minds of people that issued permits a long time ago, but in recent times, that would be to allow a degree of flexibility, but at the same time avoid environmental impacts to or detrimental environmental impacts.
So from what you've described, and again, I do lack imagination, or perhaps it's knowledge, but what you describe, it looks like secession conditions are a means to manage cumulative effects of multiple takes and use of water, at least in terms of the drawdown on the on an aquifer or drawdown on the surface flow of a river. Would that be fair? That's what they're doing? Or have I...
That is what, they will do,
And so those secession conditions are going to flows or levels in surface water bodies or groundwater bodies. It's a mechanism to manage that specifically?
Yeah, that's how they would be used nowadays.
Yeah. Because presumably, but then this is a great assumption indeed, but if you're not managing flows and levels, if you're changing flows, it is to manage the degree of change with some knowledge. If you exceed that change, then you will have a consequential effect, which is adverse and which you would otherwise wish to avoid.
Yeah.
That's the mechanism?
Yeah.
Okay.
In addition to what you were saying and what I said before, it might... In some cases, it might also take cessation conditions are also there to protect downstream users as well.
Could like be.
Yeah.
Is that like a.
That again cessation? Is like a priority, yeah, perhaps.
Yeah. So I understand, and generally, that the priorities are established on a first come, first served basis. Correct?
Correct.
So that in any one water body, there is not the successive priorities are not managed in a or allocated in a lineal fashion from the top of the catchment to the mouth of the river.
In a lot of cases that I'm in some cases where I'm familiar with, there are a few catchments that I've been working on. That is actually the case.
The
highest priority would be at the bottom of the catchment or the lowest take, the most downstream take.
But is my knowledge, always the case?
I cannot confirm.
Because you haven't done, the region hasn't done an audit of the priorities?
Correct.
Yeah.
Not to my knowledge.
And so if the priorities, for example, were not ordered in a lineal fashion such that the highest priority is at the mouth of the river? Is that what you said? Lowest point in the catchment, mouth of the river?
Lowest point of take.
Lowest point of take. What does that mean?
To give you an example, the Cadrona, for example, is a river that goes naturally dry.
Mm.
So the lowest point of take there is located above the drying reach, so not at the bottom of the catchment, but otherwise they kind of lose surety of supply. But in that case, my understanding is that the deemed permits with the highest priority are at the bottom, or the furthest downstream. My understanding as well might be worthwhile checking with Oruk later on, is that in the Manaharakia it's the same, that the take from the Manaharakia irrigation company, which is the furthest downstream, has the highest priority.
Assuming that is correct for every water body in every catchment, which is a big assumption because the region hasn't audited deemed permits to establish this, how would a secession condition work if it were to be in place of a deemed a priority? How would it be made to work?
It could be a table, basically, with the consents and their order in the priority.
Would that table need to be in a plan
change?
As a condition.
But again, as I said before, it's hard to know where the priorities are being exercised. And sometimes, and now this is an assumption, but where deemed permit holders within a catchment have not come in at the same time, and where some deemed permit holder in the middle of the pack, so to speak, has come in and applied for a new consent, that system might be uprooted as well. So it's very complex.
But in your view, for secession, for priorities to be included as secession conditions, can that be effective on anything other than a whole of catchment approach? Is my question. Or, if not whole of catchment, whole of water body. Or if not that, then something else.
It does seem that way. There needs to be a critical mass in terms of deemed permit holders being held to a priority system in order for it to work. It's a bit similar to a minimum flow. A minimum flow as well. It's almost like in the same way. If not all consent holders have a minimum flow condition on their consent, then it might not be effective.
Okay. Just a couple of more questions. Yep, go for it.
Done.
Do you want to ask your question now?
Yeah. I guess this is something that's just dawned on me, and it's probably pretty obvious. It's just 10A.3 rules. When you were taking us to chapter 12 for the rules, it's in your page 3 of the provisions. At the top of the page, note 1 in italics.
Oh, sorry, yes.
So note 1 is what you're relying on in terms of the statements made about the chapter 12 rules not this plan change applying to new activities. Mm-hmm. In other words, not the deemed ones or the ones that are going to run out in 2025 or whatever year it was. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
Right, thank you. Helpful. I'd overlooked that. And so when Mr. Page was asking you questions about 1B in terms of the text, the two new paragraphs at the end of the section entitled How to Use the Regional Plan Water.
Yes, yep.
So these are this is the only place where you have the directions as to what assessment matters are relevant in terms of the plan provisions.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes, within the chapter, Plan Change 7, yes. Yep.
But is this what the plan does generally? Because it just says two new paragraphs, so I assume that this was the structure and architecture of the plan. Is it for everything, or is this just been added because of PC 7? I mean, this approach only taken to PC 7 in terms of this text?
Yes, correct. Yep. You're referring to the section, the additions to the section, how to use the regional.
Yes.
Yep. It's quite unique in a sense that the other chapters in the plan are not standalone chapters. They should be read in conjunction. So this is the only provision in that regard.
Well, I guess I've found it a little unusual in that normally when you have this kind of thing, it's embedded in the actual provisions rather than in how to use the plan.
Yeah.
So just pondering that.
Yes.
Fair. So might it be better if it was actually...
It could provide more clarity if it was repeated perhaps at the start of Chapter 10 as well.
I just thought it might, you know, you've got something in there mm-hmm. in Chapter 10 actually on the rules, but you don't have anything in relation to the objectives and policies referred to, do you? Or even the rules, actually, all of the rules. Anyway, I think that's just a structural and clarity matter.
I agree with you.
Sorry, Judge. That's right. Me done.
So you were asked questions about whether the non-complying policy, or whether rather policy 10A, where is it? 10A 2.3 is meant to be and the amendments that you have recommended is meant to be a narrow gate.
Yes.
Or a closed gate, closed or shut gate. And both propositions, when Mr. Page has been talking to you, he's moved from narrow to, in fact, a gate being closed. And I think you answer yes narrow, yes closed. That's how I picked it up. Is it narrow or has the gate closed? Is the purpose of, you know, your amendments to shut the gate?
Well,
if it was really to shut the gate,
I guess we would have gone down the prohibited activity pathway.
Mm-hmm.
But that sets a high threshold.
Yeah.
You must be certain that there is no, you know, I don't recall the exact wording, but there is a certain test, and you must be certain that there's no inconceivable situation, or you cannot conceive a situation where a longer-term consent might be required.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't that confident that we were in that position.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I think a very, very tight non-complying activity rule is more appropriate. And if it serves the bigger purpose of Plan Change 7, which is to enable that quick transition, you could actually consider a slightly longer duration.
Okay. Then there was something else that was put to you. I'm just going to find it. I've forgotten who by, but somebody put to you, for a non-complying activity, would you still consider, would you consider the policies, 10A, 2.1, 2.2 and 2.3, and your answer was yes for a non-complying activity. How would that assist if you've got, it's not merely non-compliant because the, well, it's not merely non-compliant because the duration exceeds 6 years. It would be non-compliant because the duration exceeds 6 years. How would any of those policies assist in terms of assessing a non-complying activity, aside from the fact that policy, you know, applications greater than 6 years are not anticipated?
You mean the policies in Plan Change 7?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, the policies themselves, two letter ones, provide direction only on duration. And policy, the first one, policy 10A to 1, provides direction around the circumstances in which you could grant consent.
So 10A21 is relevant in terms of the circumstances, aside or apart from duration, that you could grant consent?
I do believe so. The policies also provide...
How would that help me as a decision maker?
Because if you're a non-complying activity, strictly speaking, for example, the schedule does not apply. This policy does give guidance as to, you know, how much we can allocate as well. It brings you back to the requirement to match historic use, sorry, to match allocation in a new consent with historic use. In the absence of the schedule, that is a very useful tool.
All right, thank you. There are my questions. Commissioner, you got any questions? No. Anything arising from the court's questions? Nothing. All right. Well, thank you very much again.
Thank you.
Your evidence.
I have two questions arising.
Two questions. Sorry.
Yes, and I thought best do it now so the witness could be released.
Yes, yes.
do you still have the operative plan in front of you? There was some discussion as to the activity status that would apply in respect of the take of water from the Clutha Mata O. And if I can take you to page 12-7 of the plan, Common Bundle 177. See a note within a rectangular box on that page.
Yes.
And the second part of that note would appear to apply to takes from the main stem of the Clutha Mata O. And at the end of the note, there's a reference as to which rules would apply.
Correct.
And is it the effect of that note that drags you down into the discretionary activity classification?
Correct, yes. Four takes of the Clutha, yes.
Okay. The second topic relates to the entry condition for the restricted discretionary activity rule, and some suggestions were identified as to how the issue over potential subjectivity in the entry condition in respect of water permit data might be resolved by either removing it as an entry condition or having a shorter entry condition. Would care need to be taken when considering such a change that the purpose of the restricted discretionary activity is only to provide a pathway where there was a data gap because of a technical reason? Mm-hmm. It's not where there's a data gap for other reasons.
That's correct, yep.
So that would need to be picked up in any redrafted entry condition?
Yes, yep.
Okay, thank you. No other questions?
All right, thank you. Okay, in that case you are released. So thank you very much for your evidence, and we may see you again later on during the hearing, so that's okay, that's to be anticipated. But thank you, we're ready. Very great. Thanks. Okay, so just going to take the lunch adjournment back at 2:00.
All rise.